Here's what a sloth sounds like. I didn't know what a sloth sounded like until I dug up that audio there. And thanks to our next guest, it turns out there's a lot I didn't know about sloths and a bunch of other creatures. She says we often get things wrong about sloths, eels, hippos, and a whole lot of other animals because we try to understand them on human terms. Lucy Cook is a zoologist and science writer. Her new book is The Truth About Animals, Stone Sloths, Lovelorn Hippos, and Other Tales from the Wild Side of Wildlife. Lucy, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, you write about all these misunderstood animals in your book, and you make the point that we know a lot in the world of science. There's still a lot we don't know about how animals behave.
Absolutely. There are still many great mysteries out there for us to solve. Things like, for instance, why we sleep, why animals sleep. We still don't really know what the purpose of sleep is. So that there are still many mysteries out there for us to try and figure out.
Well, I want to dig into some of the individual animals you talk about, the mysteries and some of the misconceptions about them. And I want to start with one of your favorites. You're the founder of the Sloth Appreciation Society, and you write that people ask you all the time, why do we have sloths? How do they survive when they're so slow and lazy? What do you tell them?
Well, yes, I get asked a lot how sloths can exist when they're such losers. and people are convinced that because they're slow and lazy, they're somehow redundant and second rate. But they are actually incredibly successful animals. They are, and the reason for their success is their slothful nature, because they are energy-saving icons. They have a whole suite of extraordinary adaptations that enable them to have to burn very little energy and have very low energy requirements. The leaves that they eat are mildly toxic, and they contain very little energy. So they survive on about 160 calories a day, which
wow.
is about the same as a packet of chips. And we'd be pretty peckish if we were if we were surviving on 160 calories a day. But one of the ways the sloth has managed to evolve to use so little energy is by turning its life upside down. You see, and an inverted existence, hanging from a tree, requires half the muscle mass of an upright existence, where your body has to hold itself erect, and that burns energy. So their topsy-turvy lifestyle may seem strange to us, but is actually incredibly energy efficient.
And people look at them and say, wow, they're so slow, but I guess if they're eating leaves, they don't need to be too fast to catch them. And you write, their predators are often a kind of bird, an eagle, I think it was, and sloths are surprisingly stealthy at hiding from their predators.
Absolutely. I mean, again, it may not be our idea of aspirational living to be covered in algae and hopping with insects, but it really works for the sloth. You know, they merge in with the trees. They're incredibly hard to see. As I know myself from having spent many years searching for them in jungles, they're very, very cryptic. And their movements are so slow. By moving so slowly, they slip under the radar of harpy eagles, which, as you say, these sort of terrifying, massive eagles. They swoop around the tree tops, scanning for movement. Unlike monkeys, which crash around a lot, sloths are very, very stealthy. So they avoid detection.
Why are we so unfair to the sloth? I mean, they're named after one of the deadly sins. I don't think there's another animal out there that shares that distinction. Why are we so down on sloths?
Well, I think that around the time when the sloth was named, it got its name was around the time of the formation of the seven deadly sins, and I think that. There was a whole sort of period of zoology when the bestiaries, these sort of medieval encyclopedias first came out, that was very judgmental about animals, and they were looking for sort of moral tales in animal behavior. And I think to a certain extent, we still do moralize about animals, and we can be quite judgmental. And, you know, we are busy bipedal apes that are obsessed with moving faster than nature intended. We think speed is incredibly sexy and something that we should strive after, you know. But actually, being slothful and stealthy is a very sustainable way of living. And I think maybe we should be less focused on being like cheetahs, and maybe we could learn a thing or two from the sloth.
I watched some of your videos of baby sloths, one where they were learning to climb. And this is still human-centric of me, but I think people watching these videos is really going to turn people around on their thoughts about the sloth. Do you agree?
Oh, yeah, I mean, they are unfeasibly cute. I mean, they really are.
They are
sort of, and sort of, and you know, I mean, because they're born with a natural smile on their face, and you know, and they love, and they need to hug, you know. So I mean, there's a sort of incredibly endearing nature to them, and they have these adorable faces. And the thing that I love about sloths so much is that, unlike, say, pandas or meerkats, which basically to human beings all look the same, sloths have got incredibly unique faces. Each one has a different, a very characterful face. And so I never get bored of taking their photograph or filming them, because each one is different, you know, and charming in its own way.
Talking to Lucy Cook, her new book is The Truth About Animals, Stone Sloths, Lovelorn Hippos, and Other Tales from the Wild Side of Wildlife. Lucy, I want to turn to an animal that I think people will find less cute, but you were into these when you were a kid, eels. Why were you almost obsessed with eels growing up?
Oh, because I go, it was so hard to catch. They're incredibly slippery, and so I was very obsessed with ponds when I was little, and pond life, and I was always trying to. My dad and I would go out sort of hunting for frogs and insects and beetles to put in my ponds that I had at home. And I could, and the eels that we caught, I could never hold on to them because they're so slippery. And I was sort of delighted to discover that throughout science, eels have fascinated scientists. For many years, all the way from Aristotle, who was like the first great zoologist, and he was obsessed with eels because he couldn't find their sexual organs. They appeared to be sexless, and so he came up with the idea that they must therefore spontaneously generate, and that the action of water on mud would somehow make them just emerge from the ground, which is a sort of ridiculous idea, obviously, to us now. And I. But if you think about it, it's no more ridiculous than the truth, which we now believe is that eels start their life in the Sargasso Sea, which is a very obscure, remote part of the Atlantic that's slap bang in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle. And then they swim thousands of kilometers, no bigger than a grain of rice. They make this epic journey that takes 1 or 2 years to the rivers of Europe, or indeed the rivers of America. And then they spend years fattening themselves up in fresh water, only so that they have enough energy in order to make the long journey back to the Sargasso in order to reproduce and then die. But working out that extraordinary migration, which is just epic in nature, was something that troubled and tormented scientists, including Sigmund Freud, in fact. Sigmund Freud, who's obviously famous as the inventor of psychoanalysis, his first job as an academic was spent slicing up eels for a summer in search of their testicles, which it took scientists forever to find their sexual organs, and because they go through 4 metamorphoses, and only in the 4th and final metamorphosis, as they're heading back from the rivers to the Sargasso, do they develop them. So they were incredibly hard to find, and Freud was one of the scientists who was tormented by this, which I think is rather amusing.
I don't want to read too much into it. I guess sometimes an eel is just an eel.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, it's a slightly phallocentric fish that tormented him, you know, so it's a kind of like a strange thing. He gave up and went after less slippery subjects like the human psyche.
And speaking of misconceptions about animals, the eel, for a long time, until surprisingly recently, people thought eels were vegetarians. They love their lentils.
Yes, exactly. I know, I found some incredibly charming old myths about animals, and one of them was, yes, there was an idea that eels were vegetarians, and they would come out of the rivers at night and forage for peas and lentils on the land, and that was something that was believed in the Middle Ages. And of course, isn't true. Eels are actually voracious carnivores, and there was an experiment that was done by a couple of Frenchmen where they placed, I think it was something like 200 or 300 young eels in a tank together, and fed them regularly, but nevertheless they still ate one another until there was only one enormous eel left.
So it's a good thing you didn't find one for your pond, in hindsight.
Yes. One for my lovely pond as a child, it would have eaten all the other inmates of my pond, so probably just as well.
I want to check out a couple other misconceptions about animals. We've heard about the vegetarian eel. Nope. The self-harming hippo? People looked at hippos and thought, these guys are bleeding. They're cutting themselves up on purpose. What's the story there?
Well, so this is really fascinating, and another one of those very sort of charming old myths. So in Roman times, it was believed that hippos were the inventors of bloodletting, because they exude this red liquid. They do actually look like they're bleeding. The first time I saw a hippo, I also thought that it was bleeding. They have this red liquid that seeps out of their skin, and it looks exactly like blood. So the Romans, who were into bloodletting as a form of medicine, if you were suffering from any number of ailments, somebody would come and let your blood cut you to sort of release the pressure, and that was a common cure in those days. And they thought that the hippo was the inventor of phlebotomy, as it was known. But actually, what's going on is the hippo is excreting this red liquid, which is actually a sunscreen. It's a sunscreen which has also antibacterial qualities to it, and possibly even insect repellent. So it's an incredibly sophisticated sunscreen. So in a way, the hippo did invent a pharmaceutical process, but it wasn't bloodletting. It was actually sunscreen.
And Lucy, as we wrap up, in a lot of the stories you tell, not just the ones we talked about, it seems like we run into trouble when we try to put human terms on the animals we're studying. So, the sloth, that's like a lazy human. Hippos are like this form of healthcare. Chimpanzees, you're right, we were researching to see how human-like we were. Are we better off just trying to figure them out on their own terms and not put our preconceptions on them?
Absolutely. I think it's almost irresistible for us to anthropomorphize animals and to look for our reflection in the animal kingdom. And you know, that's perfectly fine in kids' books. That's fine. But I think that you can't assume that animals, you understand them because they look like they're behaving in a way that's familiar to us. So if we need to really understand the context of their lives and I think respect them for what they are and not what we want them to be.
Lucy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Lucy Cook, author of The Truth About Animals, Stoned Sloths, Lovelorn Hippos, and Other Tales from the Wild Side of Wildlife.